mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth. Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, a report from PAX East, the wildly popular video game convention that rivals the geeky spectacle of Comic-Con. We'll hear about the upsurge of interest in indie game developers funded by Kickstarter. And a populist painter strikes it rich and upsets the art world with Obama-hating portraits pitched at the extreme right wing. But we begin with prevailing perceptions of working women by men whose wives don't work outside the home.
We're going to need more employees, so I'm going to allow everyone escorts, even the girls, and some kind of gift for Mr. Garner.
You're off limits.
I don't think he's the one who needs to be reminded.
He was all over you the time you wore that red dress, the one with the bow in the back that makes you look like a present. Could you wear it?
Stop it.
I didn't mean it that way. All I was saying was this is the office, and that's life. And this is good. And that's life.
John Slattery there as office playboy Roger Sterling, hitting on office manager Joan in a scene from television's Mad Men. While Roger embraces the women in his office as sex objects, Mad Men deftly portrays the 1960s-era resistance to women in positions of power in the workplace. Earlier this week, Democratic strategist Hillary Rawson took a controversial swipe at Mitt Romney during a CNN interview, saying that his pro-women campaign rhetoric doesn't match up to his reality.
What you have is Mitt Romney running around the country saying, well, you know, my wife tells me that what women really care about are economic issues. And when I listen to my wife, that's what I'm hearing. Guess what? His wife has actually never worked a day in her life.
Rawson's statement unleashed a firestorm on Twitter and among political pundits from both sides of the partisan divide. A recent study from the University of North Carolina may add some weight to her claim that men in traditional marriages, meaning those with stay-at-home wives, are more likely to look negatively upon working women. With us to explain the findings is Joanna Weiss, a columnist for the Boston Globe. Joanna, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So can you summarize the findings of the new study led by Sridhari Desai at UNC at Chapel Hill?
Sure. The study wanted to look at why women are so underrepresented on corporate boards and executive suites. And, you know, Mad Men is in the 60s. This is still a problem today. And the study posed a new hypothesis, which is what if men with stay-at-home wives are sort of subtly hostile to women in the workplace? And what they discovered was, yes, that men in traditional marriages saw presence of women in the workplace unfavorably. They perceived that organizations that had higher numbers of female employees were running less smoothly. They often denied, or more frequently denied, qualified women employees opportunities for promotion.
So you say traditional marriage defined here as men with stay-at-home wives. Any sense of how many men are living like that in the current workplace?
It's actually not as big as you might think. Close to three-quarters of American families with kids under age 15 have both parents working, you know, at least part-time. So it really is a minority of families. You also need a certain level of financial stability in order to have only one spouse working.
Mm. And the study, as you say, characterizes men who feel this way as benevolent sexists, you know, not likely to be overtly hostile towards women. So let's hear further how those attitudes actually manifest in the workplace. They may secretly be harboring these desires, but how does it come out?
Well, it might have to do with promotion, you know, looking at qualified employees and maybe assuming or promoting the men over the women. It may be about workplace policies. So, you know, willingness to work with employees on flexible time arrangements so that they could handle childcare responsibilities or daycares in the workplace. Some companies are very progressive about that. Some companies are not. And what the study poses is that the idea that women are actually just opting out of the workplace might be a little bit oversimplified. Maybe more of those women would stay in the workplace if there were policies and attitudes that were friendlier toward them.
This is actually expressed as discrimination in some of the lab experiments. Can you tell us about those?
Sure. There were two lab studies. They were conducted with male university students. So in the first one, they took about 200 male married managers, and they showed them a recruitment letter from a fictional company. And some of the participants saw a letter that had male recruiters' names in them, and the other saw a letter that had female recruiters' names. And that second letter also really overtly noted that this was a company that was committed to women's advancement. And it turned out that the men in the traditional marriages were less likely to say they wanted to work for the woman-friendly company. There was another experiment where participants got a hypothetical candidate that they were supposed to evaluate for an MBA program. So some of them got David Blake, some of them got Diane Blake, otherwise identical resume. The men in the traditional marriages gave poorer evaluations to Diane.
It is such an interesting time for women in America. I mean, on the one hand, many traditional female jobs in the public sector, the teaching, the healthcare, lost in the recession, of course, the flap over birth control. Any sense of whether these perceptions of women in the workplace extend to other political issues among men in traditional marriages?
I think it's really attractive, the idea of extrapolating this and saying, oh, you know, Barack Obama has a wife who worked outside the home and Mitt Romney's wife always stayed at home. But I think that might be a little oversimplified. You look at Mitt Romney and he has often in his political life had very high placed women in his organization. So, you know, it's hard to draw a direct line. On the other hand, I do think that women are very attuned this election season to policies across the board, social policies in the workplace, in the doctor's office that affect them. And they are quite attuned to a sense that perhaps women are being treated differently, unfairly still in many sectors.
Joanna Weiss, columnist for the Boston Globe and author of the novel Milkshake, which is about the politics of motherhood. She wrote about the recent study from the University of North Carolina called Marriage Structure and Resistance to the Gender Revolution in the Workplace. We have a link to her article and to the study at wordofmouthradio.org. The death last week of painter Thomas Kincaid has again ignited the conversation about what makes art art. The art world dismissed Kincaid's mass-marketed images of quaint cottages and sentimental landscapes and is now feasting on posthumous stories of Kincaid's predilections and bizarre behavior. Into the populist void steps John McNaughton, who is in no danger of being chosen for the Whitney Biennial. In his latest painting, a barely recognizable President Obama peers from the canvas with narrowed eyes, clutching a burning copy of the U.S. Constitution. It's not subtle, but it is all over Fox News and YouTube. Michael Hastings wrote about the art market's reaction to the controversial painter for BuzzFeed and is on the line with more. Michael, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hey, Virginia, how are you?
I'm very well. Tell us about John McNaughton. Who is he?
John McNaughton is quite a character. He's a 44-year-old white male artist. He lives in Provo, Utah. He was on a full art scholarship to Brigham Young University, which is obviously the Mormon university. And for the last 20 years, he'd painted landscapes. But starting in late 2009, he became, I guess one could say, radicalized or certainly politicized. And there was a political element to this series of paintings he's done since then.
So he is Mormon?
Yeah, he's Mormon, or at least he has a relationship with the Mormon church. I mean, what's interesting is that his first painting that he did in this series is a picture of Jesus Christ out in front of the White House. And then in his next painting called Forgotten Man, he doesn't have Jesus, but instead he put President Obama in stamping out the Constitution. And then his most recent painting, One Nation Under Socialism, shows just President Obama burning the Constitution.
Describe Forgotten Man for us with a little more detail, if you don't mind.
Sure. The Forgotten Man is quite an interesting painting. And if you go on McNaughton's website, he actually details each character he puts in. So as your listeners probably know, Norman Rockwell was famous for actually using human models, and he'd set up these elaborate stage sets, and then that's how he'd paint his paintings. He'd actually look at human models dressed as firemen or whatever the scene he was painting. McNaughton does the same thing. So in Forgotten Man, he had an actor or a model play President Obama. And then he surrounded him with people playing the founding fathers, other presidents like Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Bill Clinton. And they're sort of looking as President Obama, in their view, destroys the Constitution.
Applauding even.
Applauding, yes. Now, it's interesting. FDR and Clinton, the so-called big spending liberals, are applauding. But some of the other founding fathers are looking on with very displeased looks in their faces.
Here's a clip of John McNaughton. He's actually describing the painting. This is on his website, but it's also seen on YouTube, in fact, by almost 3.8 million people. Here he is describing it.
Because of unconstitutional acts imposed upon the American people by our government, we stand on the precipice of disaster. The painting symbolically suggests the actions of Barack Obama, as well as other presidents. Yes, their actions speak louder than words, as do the brushstrokes in my painting.
Well, we did say subtlety is not really his hallmark.
No, it's not, but it's worked out for him incredibly. One of his paintings has already been bought by Fox News host Sean Hannity, and he expects to sell one of the other paintings for $300,000 and thinks he can get six figures for this Forgotten Man painting,
wow,
which is huge. I mean, there's only about 100 or so artists in the world who can command that kind of cash for their paintings.
But people can buy prints, I guess, for much less.
Yeah, that's where he makes most of his money off the prints, between $24, I think, and $400.
So critics, what are they saying about his work?
The critics, unsurprisingly, do not like John McNaughton. He was trashed by a New York Magazine critic, and McNaughton will tell you he's also been trashed in the liberal elite hotspots of New York and Cambridge, England. They say it's didactic, they say he doesn't understand socialism, and they say it's basically too on the nose.
The art world, of course, has also scoffed at Thomas Kinkade. Now, this is the highly populist
right.
painter of, you know, homespun scenes who died just recently. Have these overtly political works exposed maybe a market for extreme right-wing art?
I think there is. I mean, clearly President Obama has inspired some very interesting artwork from his political enemies. I mean, remember, if you look back at the famous picture of President Obama's face done up like the Joker from Batman. And now you have this sort of market that's been codified, and you have someone actually making quite a bit of money selling these paintings. And the paintings actually, they're pretty fascinating to look at. And if you go onto his website, you actually can go to the different figures. And there's one painting in the One Nation Under God where there's Jesus, and you have all these sort of icons of American life surrounding Jesus. And you go over one of them, and it says liberal news reporter, right? And then there's another one that says Mr. Hollywood. So it's kind of taking this right-wing conservative political discourse and putting it in very explicit terms in its artwork.
Well, of course, art as investment property has become very popular, especially in the last 10 or 15 years. Are these works going to stand the test of time? Are they going to be worth something 10 years, 100 years from now?
Well, Sean Hannity hopefully hopes so. He's already bought one, and he tweeted the other day after we did our story that he wants to buy this other one. You know, I wouldn't be surprised that these will become collector's items at the very least that represent this moment in time, the first African-American president in this very strange political culture where the right has been totally radicalized. And you have these paintings that are almost like velvet Elvises that are popping up, and people are buying them by the bucketful.
Michael, I really want to thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Michael Hastings, a writer for BuzzFeed. There's a link to see his article at wordofmouthradio.org, where you can also see some examples of John McNaughton's artwork and the YouTube video of the painter describing The Forgotten Man and other paintings. Unflattering portraits aside, the American presidency remains the most powerful office in the world, and one that any American-born child can aspire to. One of our listeners recently shared an interesting item on our Facebook page, an essay her daughter wrote for her third-grade class at the Rumford School in Concord. The subject, "If I were president, I would..." Her answer betraying a real politic far beyond her 9 years of age.
My name is Emma Fleischman. I'm nine. If I were president, I would be super tired and cranky. I would be flustered and cross. I would say, being the president is hard work. Why would I want this job? All I ever do is give speeches and meet in meetings and make decisions and run the military and have people complain to me. It's a lot of work, but somebody has to do it, I would say.
Emma Fleischman there, reflecting perhaps a little loss of luster for the nation's highest office. We'd love to hear your response to the same prompt. If I were president, I would go to it. You can post your answer on our Facebook page or post your kid's answer. We'll include some of your responses on future programs throughout the 2012 campaign season. Coming up on Word of Mouth, the link between antibiotics and obesity. That's when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. One study that caught our eye this week explored the possible connection between prolific use of antibiotics and the obesity epidemic. New research conducted at New York University indicates that the drugs could harm communities of bacteria that help the body fight fat. We previously talked about the overuse of antibiotics leading to the development of superbugs and that antibiotics could be harming bacterial flora. So we asked Jessica Hamsloo, who wrote about the research for New Scientist magazine, to explain what the new findings revealed.
As you said, disruptions in gut flora, which can be caused by antibiotic use, has already been linked to asthma and allergies, eczema, irritable bowel disease, and even things like Parkinson's disease. Now researchers think it might be linked to the rise in obesity as well.
So you wrote about this NYU team led by Martin Blaser. How did they investigate whether overuse of antibiotics could play a part in rising obesity?
Well, Blaser's group, in their study, they gave penicillin, which is a commonly used antibiotic that probably most people will have heard of. They gave that antibiotic to mice to see what would happen to them. And they found that mice who were fed penicillin ended up 10 to 15% larger than mice that weren't given any antibiotics at all. And they were twice as fat as well, which suggests that altering the gut flora with penicillin does seem to have an effect on weight gain.
So twice as fat as drug-free mice. So what exactly was changing in the gut flora of these mice?
At this stage, all they can say is the levels of different types of bacteria seem to have changed. They haven't pinned down exactly which species are to blame, but so far they've found that one species called Lactobacillus, which is generally known as a good bacteria, it's the one you often find in probiotics, and it's linked to lower risk of cancer, that one was decreased in the mice that had been given the antibiotic.
The researchers then devised another test using so-called germ-free mice. Tell us about that experiment.
Well, we're all covered in bacteria. We pick up our first bacteria when we're born. But to find out whether the gut bacteria is really causing obesity in these mice, they bred mice in sterile environments, so they had no bacteria on them at all. And when these mice were given the gut bacteria taken from a mouse that had been fed antibiotics, they were much larger than mice that had been given the gut bacteria from a normal healthy mouse. They were about a third larger.
So they were pretty much isolating the gut bacteria as the source for weight gain. Is the connection clear? Is that something that they can say is proven now?
Well, we can say in these mice it seems to be clear, but whether or not it is for humans is a different matter. But there is one study in humans that seems to suggest it might be the case for us too, and that was a study in children. In a group in Copenhagen in Denmark looked at 28,000 babies, and those that were given antibiotics in the first 6 months of their life were more likely to be overweight when they were 7 years old, regardless of their mother's weight. And that adds more weight to the theory that our gut bacteria seems to be important and messing with them with antibiotics can lead to weight gain.
Now, these mice certainly were given an overdose of antibiotics. How about the children in Copenhagen? Are they getting a sort of normal amount that children get throughout their lives for various infections?
Yeah, these were just normal children. A lot of children tend to be given antibiotics when they have things like ear infections or a fever. If they come to hospital, they're automatically given antibiotics. So they just followed normal children. They didn't give them 30 weeks of antibiotics like the mice.
I'm wondering if children in Copenhagen are likely to receive fewer antibiotics than here in the States, where for a long time there's been complaints about the prolific use of antibiotics.
I think you could argue that antibiotics are overused in a lot of Western countries. A lot of the time when children come to hospitals with infections, the cause could be a virus. And in that case, giving antibiotics isn't going to do anything at all. But when you're in that situation, when you've got a sick child, you know, it's difficult to say you can't treat it. You want to help out. So I think the thing to do here is really work on better diagnosing what the problem is so you don't have to use antibiotics for any old thing when it might not even be useful.
We were quite interested in the sidebar of your article, which described the work of a team in Oklahoma. This team was trying to compare the gut bacteria of ancient humans to present-day people. Can you tell us about it?
So this was Cecil Lewis and his colleagues, and they collected ancient poo from mummies, from the intestines of mummies and from outside caves that humans had lived in. And they looked at the DNA of bacteria in those samples to see if they could piece together what the gut flora of ancient humans looked like. And they compared those with rural African children and also primates like gorillas and chimps and modern-day Western gut flora. And they found that our ancestors seemed to have a completely different bacteria to us, and it seemed to be similar to those of the primate and the children living in rural Africa who were less exposed to antibiotics. And it suggests that our gut floras have been changing over the years, and maybe for good.
Maybe for good, you say. So that natural flora wasn't necessarily a good thing.
I mean, it's hard to say exactly what role that flora was having in those ancient people, but our gut flora is important in so many things, from digestion to immune function. And there's a link between the brain and the gut as well, so it could possibly be important for our mood. It's tricky territory because we still don't really know. There's so many bacteria down there. We still don't really know what's doing what, but we can say that it's changed. We can say that some bugs that we had in our guts thousands of years ago don't seem to be there now, but we don't know. We don't know what effects that might be having.
So are researchers suggesting that we might try and repopulate our guts with bacteria to keep obesity at bay, you know, using things like probiotics, for example?
That's one theory. I mean, it's already being used for some cases when people have infections and disrupted gut bacteria. They can have fecal transplants where they actually take bacteria from somebody else's feces, somebody else's poo, and put it in their gut to kind of repopulate their own guts with somebody else's healthy bacteria. And that does seem to work for some people. I mean, it's early days, but if we can look to see what our ancestors' gut bacteria was like, maybe we could try and undo some of the damage that we've done by antibiotic use.
Well, it's a fascinating territory. Jessica Hamsalou, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jessica Hamsalou, writer for New Scientist magazine. For a link to her article, Medicine That Makes You Fat, go to wordofmouthradio.org. And coming up, we'll hear about some of the big developments in video games with Clay Wirestone, fresh from the PAX East Gaming Conference in Boston. That's when Word of Mouth continues after the break.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
For Word of Mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Even if you aren't a collector, you've likely heard of the annual spectacle of the comic book industry known as Comic-Con.
I was looking at my hotel room window and I saw three Ninja Turtles really impatiently checking their watches.
In the mind of every comic book fiend, Comic-Con is just the answer to all your prayers. It's like heaven, in as much as, like they always tell you, when you go to heaven, everything you've ever lost is going to come back to you.
That was Seth Rogen and Kevin Smith in a trailer for Comic-Con, Morgan Spurlock's new documentary of the mildly surreal West Coast convention. A parallel convention for gamers is growing in popularity and no shortage of passion. Last weekend, PAX East sold out its third annual conference in Boston with an estimated 100,000 game distributors, developers, and devotees. Clay Wirestone is a writer whose work has appeared in Mental Floss magazine and on the History Channel and was at PAX East 2012 and joins us in the studio to tell us about it. Clay, great to have you back.
Great to be here.
Give us a quick primer on the history of PAX East.
Well, the convention actually started on the West Coast back in 2004 by a couple of guys who draw a webcomic called Penny Arcade. It was just a few thousand people the first year, and then it grew to tens of thousands. They brought it to Boston, an East Coast version, in 2010. And last year they had more than 70,000 people there. It's grown so big that the city of Boston has actually signed them up to hold the convention there through 2023.
Well, so is there a lot of crossover between that kind of geek culture associated with comic books and video games? I mean, give us a sense of this atmosphere.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think what's interesting about it is there's so much money now that's being made both in comic books, the comic book field through the movies, and in just video games in general, that, I mean, these are not exactly niches anymore. And yet at the same time, people who are really fans of comic books and people who are really fans of video games feel a little bit like people look down on them. They feel a little bit like they're still in a minority in the mainstream. And so something like PAX East or any other kind of con is just a giant safe space for geekery.
So they can dress up in their Ninja Turtle costumes, etc.
Well, yes. I mean, there is a kind of a misapprehension, I think, sometimes about conventions that everybody goes dressed as a Pokemon, let's say. But I would say it's probably less than 1%. That being said, they're very noticeable.
The ones the cameras train on, obviously.
Oh, absolutely. And, I mean, there were some really great costumes. I mean, some very random folks, too, like Colonel Sanders, the comic book guy from The Simpsons. There was somebody dressed as the Phantom of the Opera for some reason. I was actually really interested to see how many people are dressed as Doctor Who, which, is obviously a series that's been going on for decades now over in Britain, but it really seems to have caught on for the American gamer geeks.
Well, of course, it's a place for news. It's a place for the industry, but no new consoles were announced at PAX East. So what does that signal? That it's more of a fan conference than a place where business gets done?
It's definitely focused on fans. I mean, there's a big business conference for video games that's held every year. It's called E3, the Electronics Entertainment Expo, and that's going to be held in June in Los Angeles. And if there's really big announcements, you'll probably see some of them there.
So let's look at some of the big games being talked about. One of them, the third in the BioShock series, BioShock Infinite is what it's called. Let's hear a little bit from that.
Just a postman. He didn't hurt anybody.
It's DeWitt!
It's DeWitt!
Get him!
All right, I'm having a bit of a deja vu. Haven't we heard about this game before?
Oh, absolutely. BioShock Infinite was actually announced back in August of 2010. It has a big presence at PAX East because the developer Irrational Studios is based in Quincy, Massachusetts. But it's just really an indication of how long these kind of top-of-the-line, graphic-intensive games take to develop.
So a lot of buzz around the game Secret World is here just a bit from an extremely cinematic trailer.
What if I told you there was a secret world? A world where dark creatures stalk the city streets. Where secret societies pull the strings of presidents, the media, and powerful CEOs. Now, what if I told you that world is ours?
And if you think that BioShock Infinite has been in the works for a long time, The Secret World actually had its development start back in 2002.
Wow, that is a long time. much longer than Hollywood films, certainly. And we have previously talked about how huge the video gaming industry is, in fact, overtaking Hollywood in production and marketing. And yet, you discovered at PAX East a lot of interest in indie games.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think there's almost a parallel convention going on for these smaller-scale developers. You know, even as short a time as 2 years ago, I think, if you went to PAX East, a lot of the interest from the indie developers would be, well, I want to get my game on the PlayStation, or I want to get my game on the Xbox or Wii. You know, I want to attract the interest of the big publishers. But, you know, what's really changed now is that basically every indie game I saw, or every indie developer that I saw at the expo, they were really aiming for the iPad. They were aiming for the iPhone.
Uh-huh. So something that everyone can carry around, probably not quite as complicated and easier to develop.
Oh, absolutely. And potentially much more profitable because you're not trying to split your money with a publisher or a console maker. I mean, much of it goes directly to you.
So PAX East apparently made efforts to highlight the small guy. They set up a Boston Indie Showcase. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, sure. They selected six games that were kind of meant for mobile devices. One of the ones that I especially enjoyed is a game called Spell Tower. All you really need to know are three words, Scrabble meets Tetris. So if that sounds appealing to you, that's great. There's also a game called a Lawnmower Challenge, which is kind of a puzzle game that involves mowing a lawn, but it's much more addictive than actually lawn mowing.
So a lot of people getting in on this, and a lot of them getting funding on Kickstarter, which has become a sort of go-to place for indie artists, filmmakers, reporters, writers, and now video game developers. Is Kickstarter becoming like a player in the industry?
Oh, it's huge for video games right now. It actually had its own room at the conference that had its own separate exhibitors, people that had gotten their funding through Kickstarter. The big breakthrough, actually, for video games came a couple of months ago when the former LucasArts adventure game developer Tim Schafer, he made a game called The Secret of Monkey Island back in 1990. He made a pitch on Kickstarter to make an old-school style point-and-click adventure game on Kickstarter. They were looking for $300,000 to make this game, very bare bones. They ended up raising over $3.3 million on Kickstarter. It was an astonishing success. And at a panel I went to about the Kickstarter funding phenomenon, they said that actually 71% of the people who donated to that game had never been on Kickstarter before. But 21% of those people then stayed to donate to other things.
Interesting new funding model. I did have a look at the list of panels and programs, and I was completely overwhelmed. I couldn't even imagine being there. Do you have a clear kind of PAX East takeaway from all this?
You know, I think it's really hard because not only do you have that major exhibition hall with all the big players, you have all the panels, you have all the indie folks, you have a concert series, you have video game tournaments. You have a whole section devoted to board game and tabletop games like Dungeons and Dragons and things. So a lot of the experience is up to you. But that being said, I was really struck by kind of how in flux the industry seemed. You had this huge money on the main floor, but then you had the crowdfunding through Kickstarter. You had people turning towards the iDevices. And so even though these people don't have the money, there's a sense, I think, that the balance of power in the industry is really shifting to these kind of smaller, possibly more creative games.
Well, interesting wrap. Thank you so much, Clay, for coming in.
Oh, absolutely.
Clay Wirestone is a writer whose work has appeared in Mental Floss magazine and on the History Channel, and he's arts editor for the Concord Monitor and also kind enough to fill us in on the video game universe from time to time. You can find more about PAX East and some of the games we talked about at wordofmouthradio.org. And now to a new tactic in military intelligence gathering. The U.S. Navy has contracted with a private firm to buy up old gaming consoles to extract sensitive data on game players. Jacob Aaron is technology reporter for The New Scientist, where we found his article about this new strategy. Jacob, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks.
Well, first, what do we know about the company, Obscure Technologies, that the Navy hired for the job?
So not a lot, to be honest. They're kind of living up to their name. I had a look to see what I could find online. They've successfully cracked games consoles in the past. So the original Xbox, which came out about 10 years ago now, they seem to have been able to crack into that and find that information. And the contract with them says that they're the only U.S. company capable of doing it, apparently.
What kind of information are they finding when they crack these Xboxes and other technologies?
So obviously there's, you know, anything connected to games, save data, things like that. But consoles these days are very sophisticated and have lots of other options. So you can send messages, text messages, or you can send voice messages. And it's possible that they're able to go in there, dig them out, and find them.
So they're looking for communication between game players, so to speak.
Yeah, essentially. Or, indeed, anyone who just happens to be using the game as a means of private communication.
Where does Obscure Technology find these old consoles?
The contract specifies that they should purchase game systems from outside the U.S. That might be because they're interested in finding out information on gamers outside the U.S. It might be because there's restrictions on what they can do about U.S. citizens' data. They've been asked to acquire consoles in such a way that they'll have consumer data still on them. So that means they're looking for used consoles from a local game shop or a place like eBay, I guess.
We have read in the past about terror groups possibly using games like Call of Duty as training tools. Does that figure into the interest that the military might have in getting their hands on those consoles?
I've seen reports as well saying terrorists are using Call of Duty as a training tool. It seems extremely unlikely. I mean, something like a flight simulator is somewhat realistic in that, you know, you're flying around a plane in a realistic location. Call of Duty essentially takes place in a fictionalized version of our world and is very much focused on, you know, gamers just having fun. I think that they're not really particularly interested in the content of the games. What they're interested in is using it as a communication tool that the military might not be aware of. So there are other ways that terrorists can communicate that you might not think of. For example, sending an email is quite risky. That can be easily picked up. But what you can do is log into an email account, write a message, save it as a draft, but not send it, and then let someone else log in, read your message, and delete it. So they're always looking at ways of using technology to send messages in a secret way, and this is just one aspect of that.
Well, Jacob, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Great. Thanks very much.
Jacob Aaron, technology reporter for New Scientist magazine. You'll find a link to his article about hacking foreign video game consoles at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, a family embraces their wild side over Friday night dinner, letting kids eat like cavemen. That's when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Decades ago, John Wiebenson decided to take over Friday night dinners for his family, despite the fact that his cooking comfort zone was pretty much limited to meat and, well, more meat. So he made just that, and as a special treat, let his children eat it like cavemen. WAMU's Jessica Gould brings us the story of Wildman Night, now one family's beloved tradition.
It's Friday night at the Wiebenson house. The steak is sizzling, the potatoes are baking, and things are about to get a little bit wild. 8-year-old Tristan Wiebenson explains.
So you eat with your hands, You make a fire, and when you're done eating, you growl.
Tristan's grandmother, Abigail, says Wild Man Night began years ago, back when her three sons were small, and she had her hands full as a working mom.
I was really tired. I had three children and a full-time job, and it was the end of the week, and I was done.
Abigail says that's when her husband, John Wiebenson, or Weeb for short, offered to take over.
He was not a cook. He had a very limited menu that he could do. He would bring five shrimp. He would get steak, he would get five baked potatoes, and he would get three comic books.
He hid the comic books, which the children would find as part of a pre-dinner scavenger hunt. Then they would sit down to eat. Utensils were purely optional.
He would pour sparkling cider into the glasses, and then he would propose a toast, and the toast would be to an ancestor, but we wouldn't just clink glasses, we would growl.
Weep's son John says he was about 10 years old when Wild Man Night began.
I think it was just a great kind of moment to sort of pull us all together.
And John says Wild Man Night was just one of the ways we brought excitement and whimsy into the boys' everyday lives.
And it was just Saturdays that included metro adventures in which we would get on the metro and kind of pick a stop and just ride the metro and see where it took us.
He even remodeled the family's DuPont Circle row house, transforming it into a veritable jungle gym of wooden ladders and secret passageways. Abigail says it was just Weeb's way to make life better for his children and for everyone.
He was always a man who believed in the underdog.
As an architect, Weeb did a lot of pro bono work for local schools and charities. He was especially devoted to Martha's Table, a nonprofit that provides food, clothing, and educational opportunities to low-income families. In the fall of 2003, Weeb was helping out with improvements there when tragedy struck.
He had renovated several of the buildings there on 14th Street, and this was the last.
The building had been a car repair shop, but he hoped to make it into a space for after-school programs. First, he had to clean out the basement.
All of the things that people had taken out of the cars, the oil and the toxic things, they'd thrown into the basement. And so he had gotten gallons and gallons of that stuff taken out. And he went down to just check it again, and the toxicity had come back, and he was asphyxiated.
It was devastating for the family. But if Weeb had taught them anything, it was to embrace life and enjoy the moments they had together. So several months later, when Weeb's son Derek got married, the family decided to host a Wild Man dinner for the guests. Now, John Wiebenson carries on the tradition with his sons, Tristan and Oliver, who's six.
I hope they kind of can understand that, you know, I think it's good to be a little crazy, know there's a time for that, and know there's a way to do it that still is part of the family and still is part of, you know, a great tradition.
So John hides the comic books.
All right, start walking. Warm.
Hot! On fire!
Then the boys sit down to eat. They smash the potatoes with the palms of their hands and tear the meat with their teeth. Finally, when only empty potato skins and gristle are left, John makes a toast.
To my dad, John Wiebenson, Weeb, who started this and brought this sort of wonderful tradition that I'm very happy to pass on to Tristan and Oliver and hope that they continue it in their own wild ways.
And on the count of three,
one, two, three.
The boys lift their glasses of sparkling cider and growl. For their grandfather. I'm Jessica Gould.
Eating like cavemen is one family bonding method. Another slightly less messy activity is playing board games. Earlier in the program, Clay Wirestone gave us his take on the PAX East video game convention in Boston and pointed out that there was a segment of the convention devoted to board games. Not quite of the Risk, Parcheesi, and Clue variety, now regarded with a kind of genteel nostalgia. Leon Nafok reported for the Boston Globe Ideas section on what enthusiasts are calling a renaissance in board games. Fueling the popularity are disciples of so-called German-style designer board games, which Leon distinguished for us from the board games of our youth.
So German-style games are more strategic. There's less left up to chance. You don't just roll a die and move around a board, and there's not just one way to win. they often sort of revolve around a kind of clever, what's called a game mechanic. So for instance, one of the more popular games from recent years is a game called Forbidden Island, where players aren't actually playing against each other, but they're playing on a team together. And so the real kind of distinction between German-style games and sort of what you and I are probably used to is that these things are kind of more innovative on a structural level.
You note that there is a documentary film now out about board games. There are university courses, huge gatherings of enthusiasts. So when did the U.S. start to develop this subculture of German-style enthusiasts?
It was really in the mid-90s when American gamers started paying attention to these board games. It was thanks largely to Settlers of Catan, which was imported in 1995. And thanks to the internet, which allowed for people to kind of trade games and find out about games they hadn't heard of and start actually importing them from Germany and actually translating them into English and then meeting up, you know, and sharing them with each other. And that was sort of what gave rise to this pretty vibrant subculture, which has now grown pretty significantly.
And I guess you're in an epicenter there in Cambridge.
Yeah, that's sort of what I kind of found out when I was reporting the story, is that we have a couple of stores in the Boston area. One is The Games People Play in Harvard Square, which turns out to be the first store in America that actually imported German games into the U.S.
Is there a profile for the new board game player or designer?
A profile? So, you know, it's a pretty nerdy activity. You know, I think a lot of people who play board games on this level are maybe there are people who also played Magic the Gathering when they were younger or still do. Some of these board games are sci-fi oriented. But I think in general, the one wonderful thing about them is that they have pretty general appeal. They're relatively simple. Like most of the best ones have rules that are easy to learn and they can be played by anyone.
You spent time with two young game designers. Their newest creation is called Cosmic Pizza. So maybe describe it for us so we'll get an idea of how different these games are.
Yeah, so Cosmic Pizza is a pretty special game. You play as a pizza delivery guy, flying through space delivering pizzas to different planets. And the way it works is you pull cards, sort of give you ways to move around the board. So like you might pull a card that says, you know, move two spaces up and three spaces over, or one space down and two spaces diagonally. You accumulate these cards, and during your turns, you kind of put them together in ways that get you from one place to another. And so you're kind of flying around from one place to another, delivering pizzas. You know, you're avoiding asteroids that can knock you off course, and you're collecting tips every time you deliver a pizza.
There are other games designed around really kind of bizarre, but very clever on some level concepts. Tulip Mania is one, Chicken Caesar. Tell us a little bit about these.
Yeah, I mean, the wonderful thing about some of these games is that they are really themed around extremely esoteric and specific things. Like you mentioned, Tulip Mania 1637 is about the tulip craze that swept Holland 400 years ago. It's an auction-based game, and so you're sort of playing, you know, in an economic bubble. There's another game called Power Grid that's pretty popular right now, which puts you in the shoes of like a company building an electrical infrastructure for a network of cities.
Did you try any of these, Leon?
Yeah, so I played Dominion, which is a deck-building game that has been very, very successful over the last couple of years.
Deck-building?
Yeah. So deck-building means that you have cards that you draw, and they represent resources and money and different actions that you can take, and you kind of have them in your possession, and you choose how to deploy them as you go. It's a game where every player on the table kind of has their own deck, and your object, in a way, is to build the best deck possible.
Did you have fun? I mean, did it hold your interest?
Totally. I mean, you know, it was a little bit rough going at the beginning because the rules are actually kind of deceptively complex. You know, I watched a couple YouTube videos that sort of showed the game in action, and after that, I was kind of off to the races. Like, it was me and three other people who were playing it together. None of us had played before, and within, I would say, like an hour, we were kind of really into it and didn't want to stop. So it was really fun.
How are designers considering the needs of today's audience? I mean, shorter attention spans, being used to video games, maybe. How are they accounting for this?
Well, so one thing I'll say about these games is that they don't take a whole lot of time to play through. You mentioned Monopoly and Risk earlier. Those are games that are notoriously laborious. You have to sit there for hours and hours until it's over. And by the end, no one's having fun. So a lot of these games, they're really supposed to take 45 minutes to an hour. So that's one thing. You know, in terms of how they stack up against video games, I think that they kind of appeal to a different kind of fun, right? They encourage people sitting around a table together. They encourage a sort of interaction between players. And I think one thing that the designers of these games are really focused on is kind of inventing new ways for people to interact with each other, which is something you're getting with video games too now, like with a lot of these dance games and these music games. But, you know, with a board game, there's sort of the sense that you're opening up a box and you are kind of activating this world that's living in this box.
Leon Nafok, a freelance reporter who wrote about the board game renaissance for the Boston Globe. You'll find links to his article and more on some of the games we've mentioned at our website. You can pass go at wordofmouthradio.org. thank you for playing with us today. As always, we welcome your ideas and your feedback and invite you to take a turn posting on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio, or by sending us a tweet at Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again for Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Virginia Prescott,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with oversight and direction
from Abby Goldstein, NHPR's Vice President of Programming,
and web support from Brady Carlson,
and Courtney Kenya.
Andrew Perella gives technical support,
and Dan Colgan. Dan the man runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individual,
not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Really anybody else.
For information about the show, to listen to past segments, post a comment, or read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Or use the On Demand tab on the NHPR app.
You can join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
And you can follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.